Hey guys, I'm Mark Potter, and welcome to another episode of Brushstrokes, a podcast powered by Canvas Magazine. Guys, today's episode is a fun one for me because I have known my guest, Dr. John Leiniger, for several years. He is a professor of graphic communications at Clemson University, and I've had the privilege of speaking at Clemson to many of his students over the course of the last few years. And he is someone who's been around for a while and seen several different generations, several different iterations of technology, and has had the privilege of working with some of the most renowned brands in our industry. He is retiring and moving on to another chapter of his life that he talks about in our podcast. And he's got some great perspective. I am particularly taken with his perspective on this idea that we need to teach by doing. And that's what graphic arts is all about. Our industry is all about. He has some interesting advice for the industry around learning and being a learning organization, reaching out to this new generation. It's got some perspective on this new generation as well. And I was just thrilled with the conversation. He's been a good friend and someone that I really admire. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. John Leiniger. Today's episode is brought to you by Convertible Solutions. For more than 10 years, Convertible Solutions has been creating innovative pre-converted solutions for the digital print industry, allowing you to produce short-run and/or variable data jobs in the only the quantity needed, and the delivery is finished, converted pieces with no outsourcing required. So to learn more about them, go to convertiblesolutions.com. And their stuff is fantastic. My business cards are done by them. And every time I hand them out, somebody comments about how amazing they are. So they are good friends, and I appreciate them sponsoring this podcast. So without further ado, I would like to present my conversation with Dr. John Leiniger. Enjoy. I appreciate you giving me a call and spending some time. And, you know, I thought that you and I, we've known each other for a while, and I've been to Clemson and spoken to some of your students, and you know, I've obviously been an admirer of your program and you and your commitment to the industry. So, you know, I thought it would be a great chance for you and I to talk and share with our readers, our community, if you will, a little bit about what, you know, your perspective on the industry, your perspective on the generation coming up. You know, I know that you are moving on to bigger and better things, so I want to hear a little bit about that and all that kind of stuff. So hopefully you're okay with that.
That's fine.
Cool.
That'd be great.
Listen, so tell me, all right, so let's talk about the give us the lay of the land in terms of, you know, how you came to Clemson and this whole program, and you know, how long have you been there, and give me the 411.
411. Well, I actually it's interesting. I've been teaching 40 years, and what's interesting was the 39 years ago was the first time I ended up having a contact with Clemson, and I graduated in 78, and in that time teaching, I got a teaching certificate, and I had 5 years to get a master's degree and 2 years teaching experience. So I went out and started teaching in Connecticut for one year, and then I said, well, I'm going to start on my master's degree, and I went back to my school, and they had a conference going on, and they had a visiting teacher from Clemson University named Paige Crouch. And so I took a class from him, and I still remember it so plainly that I went there, and doing color separations at that time was very involved, very detailed. And the class that was teaching it before I graduated, I knew they were teaching it. It was a semester-long class, and you made one color separation, and you did all the stuff. So I come in with a six-week class figuring I'm going to do this. He comes in with a totally different approach to teaching, and in the first day and a half, I did my first color separation. And in the second day and a half, I had done a second color separation by another way, through proofing and everything. And I'm like, this is amazing. I learned so much in just basically 3 days of a six-week class. And the rest of the summer session, it just kept going like that. So at the end of it, he invited us down to take a look at the program to see if we might want to be a graduate assistant there. So my wife and I headed down on one of our breaks from teaching that next year and visited the university. Everything worked out. He made an offer for us to become grad assistants. So in I finished that second year of teaching, and then in 1980, I went down to Clemson and was a master's student for a year. I talk about it like I sold my soul, and I just did whatever I needed to for him, and we did some great things. And my wife was there, too, and she was working on some projects with him. I was doing some teaching, and we spent a year there, and then after that, I went and taught up in Charlotte for 5 years. But I think my attention had changed, that I didn't want to teach in high school anymore. I wanted to teach in college because I wanted the challenge of what was going on there. So I kept trying to get back. I was teaching at a community college at that time and had a chance to come back. Applied the first time and didn't get it at Clemson. Applied the second time 5 years later and then ended up coming to Clemson in 1986. And honestly, the reason I came to Clemson was because of Sagecraft. And his philosophy was teaching by doing. And so it was a very hands-on program. Over my years, I've been in every graphics program in the country, every major graphics program in the country, for a conference that rotates around to different colleges. And to this day, still Clemson is the most hands-on. They're all hands-on, but Clemson really pushes it further than anybody else. And I think that's one of the best things as far as having people learning. And, you know, the more you can do, the more you're likely to retain it if you just start talking about it on status words. And so we're very, very, we've always been very, very focused, and I think that's what drew me to Clemson in the first place, and what continued to make it the only place I ever really wanted to work in all my years of teaching.
Yeah, and it's interesting that that's, I mean, I think that's a great story, and I think that the philosophy of teaching by doing, hands-on, I mean, it's probably more applicable than ever before, you know, because we live in this world where they, let's face it, I mean, we just don't have the experiences that we used to. I always talk about how, you know, I grew up and you know, I was running around the neighborhood, I was gone, you know, and today, you know, we're all so immersed in our own worlds, and you know, with all the things going on in the world, we tend to, I don't know, we dig ourselves in and we protect ourselves, and we're living kind of without our heads up and seeing things, and so it's, you know, in a lot of ways, your program over the course of time is also an analogy or a metaphor for what we should be seeking today. Don't you, I mean, do you sense that? I mean, you've seen a lot of kids and, you know, you've got this program that is all about touch, feel, getting your hands dirty, experiences. Are we not more desperate for that than ever before?
I think we are in some ways. I think, you know, that we came up with a mission statement about 25 years ago at Clemson, and we've changed it slightly recently, but I still like the first one. That mostly the key point is, in the mission statement, it said that our goal was to develop dedicated, practical, problem-solving people. And it goes on for the printing, publishing, and allied industries. But to me, it was those three words together with dedicated, practical, problem-solving person. And I'm a firm believer that practical problem-solving comes from doing things, not from reading about it. And that, you know, we learn by our failures, and we learn by doing it multiple times. And then when you learn to do two different things and you're a problem solver, you can put two things together and make a third thing out of it. And I think that that's, a philosophy. And really, it was Paige Crouch's initial philosophy that made that work. But then we all sort of bought into it and pushed the students and try to make sure that they understand. I mean, the last few years I haven't been teaching in the press room, but when I would teach in the press room, and we would have press rooms that, you know, could go anywhere from 4 to 10 to 12 hours if things were going wrong. I still remember going up to one or two students, you know, when we're 10 hours into this and things aren't going really well, and then just looking at them, and they're, you know, a little down. I go, I cannot believe how lucky you are to have all these extra problem-solving experiences. What you're getting out of this project is just amazing, that you're really going to be able to use this in the future, because we had to solve so many things that weren't just working perfectly for you. In fact, sometimes when a press run would go perfectly, it's almost like the student got cheated, because, first of all, they get a swelled head thinking, oh, I'm just really good because it all worked right. They just were lucky, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think in today's world, we are trying to automate things. And even for the students, I think it's interesting how some of the students, the millennials that are in classes now, will say, why can't we just automate this? Why do we have to do this? And it's like, you know, if everything's automated, why do they need you? You know, I mean, if it's cost effective to automate, you automate. But if it's not, or if it's impractical to do those things, then you need an individual to be involved that can think on their feet. And it goes back to practical problem-solving people, that if you are a practical problem-solving person, when things come up, you're able to deal with it. So I like that. I've always liked that. It's one of my favorite things about the program, and I just think it makes a really, really good statement. And I think it's also easy to keep reinforcing to the students why they're working on things, and not just, you know, it's not just busy work. It's not just get the project done. It's what are you getting out of the project, and what are the life skills? It's what I always tell them. Like when they're writing things on their LinkedIn page, you know, don't just say, I went to Clemson. Well, what type of things did you do at Clemson, and what life skills did you get out of it that you're going to be able to apply when you get out in the real world and you get in a job? And I think those are important things. And again, that's what we're trying to do, is to create life experiences for the students that helps them down the road in everything they do.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, John, I think that's really interesting and so compelling, because, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, you know, I had my son out in the yard. You know, we had to clean the gutters this past weekend. And you know, and I grew up doing, you know, all that kind of stuff. It wasn't like I was any great hard worker, but we, you know, I did chores around the house, and I had summer jobs every year, and you know, I got my hands dirty. And today, you know, I look back, you know, maybe in the moment they weren't great experiences. I don't recall, but they certainly feel like great experiences now, and they made me appreciate hard work. They made me appreciate a lot of different things, value of money, that type of thing. So I had him out there, and I'm looking at him, I'm like, God, he's just got really no experience in doing in this generation, or these, you know, coming up, a lot of them don't have those experiences. And I understand there's not a lot of summer jobs out there, that type of thing. But it does, if you turn the page, you know, it makes you think that maybe our education system it needs to be changed or a little bit. I mean, to go to a program like yours gives them those tactical, you know, experiences. And I don't know, getting their hands dirty is a big deal. And I think there's even a confidence that comes from it, and that we're missing collectively, because, you know, we have a world full of false confidence. You know, self-esteem, I believe, is earned. And, you know, you can game the traditional education system. Let's face it. I mean, we've got parents doing kids' homework, and you know, you can Google everything. But when you're on press, or you're working on a digital machine, you know, when you're doing all that kind of work, I don't know, isn't there some self-esteem that comes from that?
Oh, right. I think I used to call it the the unwritten objectives. You know, you want to, we had a 25-inch two-color offset press that, again, you know, if you put it all together, even if you have a perfect press run, you start from a dry press, you print it, and you clean it all up and go through the whole thing. Even if you do that, even if you just run 200 sheets and it's done and you had a perfect run, it's still going to take you better part of an hour and a half to 2 hours to get it all done right. And for most of them, that's one of the biggest things they've ever done, where they had to stay at something and we had to connect all the dots. So I think those are huge things. And I think, you know, we talk about digital devices today. I don't think that you're getting the same type of developmental effort because the digital press makes a lot of things work. It don't. Now, there are other problems that come up with digital printing and understanding that. And there's still plenty of problem solving that you need to do. But I think those experiences, when they're in the lab, and again, I mean, there were late nights and you had to do all sorts of things and figure it out. And where did the problem? Sometimes you had to take three steps backwards before you go forward again. Those were all practical things that happen in real life. So, you know, I think giving people the experiences are right. And it's one of the things I used to tell people all the time is I never, ever teach shortcuts, because if I teach somebody a shortcut, so I'm just trying to be efficient and get the job done. That's one thing that I really criticize a lot of teachers when I watch them. They sort of help make their students move through the projects faster so that they can get done and out of there and everybody's out of the lab on time and all that. But the reality is, if you teach them a shortcut and then someday they have to do it the long way, they don't know how to do it. You cannot usually figure out the long way if you just know the shortcut. But if you know the long way, you can always see the shortcuts when they come up. And I think, and then you use them. So I think that we need to recognize that it's sort of developing this pattern or philosophy inside people that makes them, you know, ready to take on the challenges. Because the one thing that's happening today, as much as any other time in our career, it's just a little more visible, is it's constantly changing. And it may be a little more rapid. And, you know, you have to learn to adjust to whatever's coming at you, because it isn't the same as it was a year ago. I think that's it. I look back at my grandfather and, you know, when I was a small boy and he was working and his job wasn't changing much. He was just going every day and doing the same thing. I look at the number of times we've retooled at Clemson in all the years that I've been there, and it's just phenomenal. I mean, the equipment's gone, the building's been torn out, we've got new rooms where other rooms were. And, you know, that's the cosmetic side. But if you look at how many versions of software we've gone through from, you know, it used to be Cork Express with King of the Hill, then PageMaker, and then after that you had InDesign came in, and now we're on, you know, InDesign 10. You know, I mean, it's just the changes are constant, and they have to be able to do that, and they have to adjust to it. So I think that's really important. And I think that, you know, I really think it comes down to teachers need to recognize that the most efficient way to teach people is not necessarily the most streamlined, get it through. Because as I always used to tell the students, I'd ask them the first day of class, when they get in this one class, I said, what's the end product of this class? And they all knew about the class, and they'd say, oh, it's the book. It's the book that we produced this book. I go, no, it's the experience in the class. That's the end product. Mm-hmm. You have to focus on the experience, not on, I printed this piece of paper and this is what I'm delivering. Now, when you're in the real world, the end product is what you're selling somebody, but it's how good are you at getting it there that you make it right or you make it wrong.
Right, right. Yeah, I just can't help but think that what you're saying is so applicable to our business, you know, our industry. Or business in general, that, you know, we need to get people involved from an experiential standpoint. And you know, we all are craving that. Even as customers, we're craving that. And you know, I think that's a great lesson. Because I get concerned that, you know, we've got, and I don't want to say generations, I mean, but collectively, there's, I don't want to say lazy, but that we feel like we want to stay in our comfort zone. And we've got, like you said, you talk about your grandfather. I mean, it's kind of indicative of the history of our economy, right? Where the industrial age was set for so long that people just wanted to get into roles and feel competent and safe and secure and not necessarily get out of their comfort zone. And yet the world has changed every single day. And so now you've got to create this new type of attitude, mindset, a new generation of worker that can kind of combine the best of the past, you know, the hard work, and yet also adapt on the fly. And so with that, as you look at this industry, you know, and I want to come back to the generation and get your perspective on the generation and how they fit in this new landscape. But let's talk about the landscape of the business in the industry. From your perspective, from you know, it's not just an academic's perspective, because you get to, you've been involved with many organizations from a consulting standpoint. Where's this thing going? And you know, do you have, are you bullish on the future of this industry? And what are the type of things that you see that are emerging?
Well, I think the industry has great opportunity in the future. I would have to say that when I look at it, and again, I go to a lot of conferences and a lot of events and talk to a lot of people. I'm lucky enough to go in a lot of companies. I think that it's maybe even more tenuous today, in that you're taking a bigger risk, because you can come out with something and make technology work today, and 12 months down the road, somebody can come out with something that totally replaces it, and your investment hasn't been paid off. So I have a lot of appreciation for the owners and the people that are running companies, and the stress that they're dealing with as far as making the decisions on, do we buy this, do we not buy this? Look at inkjet technology that's coming out, the high-speed inkjet devices, and HP has one, Canon has one, Xerox is pulling one out, and all these different ones are coming out. And what they're trying to do is compete on a higher level with offset lithography, to take some more of the work away from offset lithography. Some of the new equipment that's coming out, I mean, right now the rule of thumb people usually talk about is somewhere between 500 and 2,000 is sort of a changeover from offset to digital. But with the new inkjet technology, I think you're looking at they're going to be biting into up to 10,000 impression runs on offset. And I think when you start doing that, it really changes the game, especially when you recognize that most offset press runs are now down below 5,000. So all of a sudden, you know, inkjet is going to change the way people are doing it. So you invest in a multi-million-dollar piece of equipment, and in 2 years, there's something else that's outdoing it. I think there's a, you know, that change is difficult, but at the same time, you need to be adjusting the change. So do I think the industry's going to be fine? As long as people recognize that they have to keep evolving. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I didn't say this earlier when I was talking about how I got into this, but when I went to college, I went to college to be an industrial arts teacher and teach woodworking.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't until I took my first graphics class in my major. You had seven different areas in industrial arts, and we had to take five of the seven. And I didn't want to take ceramics because I didn't want to play in mud. And I didn't want to take electricity because my dad was an electrical engineer and taught me a lot about electricity, and I felt like I knew most of it already, so I didn't want to do it. And so I go and I take this graphics class, but I didn't know what it was. And the first day I was ready to drop it because nothing was making sense. But when we took a break, everybody in the hallway didn't know what was going on, and I figured, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And then when I got into it, I think right to run a press. I'm a very methodical, mechanical person, and running a press just came very naturally to me. So it sort of worked well, and I excelled in it, and everything was great. But the reality was, I also had that point in my life, and I said, well, you know, I love woodworking. I still do it. I still make things and make clock cases and fix things and stuff. But at that point when I was in college, I said, well, you know, woodworking really hasn't changed much in the last 50 years, but printing's changing all the time, maybe sometimes too fast for me, but it has over the years. I mean, it's been a total retool. When I was cleaning out my office and closing out my career at Clemson, I'm cleaning out my office, and I'm really looking back at 40 years worth of things that I'd either written or teaching aids or different things that I did, and I realized how much has changed. And I knew, you know, throwing this away and going, man, none of the other teachers even know what this is. You know, Nobody looks at a proportion you're running for. Nobody looks at a Kodak Hackstone calculator. Nobody looks at that anymore. Right? Everything is on the computer and does it. But all those things built us to where we are. And no matter where we're going to be in 10 years, it's going to take wherever we are now to build on what we know now to get that point. So as long as people are willing to, I tell this when I hear students, high school students come in and they're looking at the program, and a parent might say something like, I heard printing said, and I go, no. And yes, there's certain areas of printing that are going away, newspapers that wouldn't invest in newspapers in today's world. Mm-hmm. But there are other things that are showing up that were never there before. And as long as you're willing to adjust and change, and again, I go back to that practical problem-solving person, and I tell that to parents. I said, if your child becomes a practical problem-solving person, they'll always have a job. Because if I got a button pusher and I got a practical problem-solving person, and the time we get a band, I'm getting rid of the button pusher, I'm keeping the practical problem-solving person. They will always be the last one standing.
Right.
And will always be the one that gets advanced and moves up. So I think those are the things, it's the attitude. And I really go back to, I don't think I've ever made a student a good student. I think they come in a good student, and then I get to sort of give them a manicure or make them look a little better. The reality is they have to come in. And I would tell you my own personal feeling looking over all the years that I've teaching, it has more to do with the family than anything else. If they have a really, really good, strong upbringing and learning and education is important to them, then they're going to be successful. But if they don't have that strong work ethic, there's nothing you can do when they're at that point in their life. They still can change. Our students have to intern 2 times during their 4 years at Clemson. And, I'm disappointed to say, but at least in all the time I've been here, I know that six students in the 32 years I've been here were actually fired on an internship. And that's devastating because they lose that semester, they can't get back into classes the next semester, and they've lost money, they've done everything. But sometimes that's what gives them the incentive that I have to retool where I am today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that I think sometimes people have to get knocked down to the point where they've got to realize, I can't keep doing what I'm doing. I've got to do it differently, and then they can be great. I have one student, when I look back on all my years, I have one student, I don't know if people would think this badly say this, but we would sit there and say, you know what? I know that student's going to get fired from his first job. He's got a terrible attitude. He's going to get fired from his first job. You can't act like that when somebody's giving you a paycheck. You do that, people get mad, angry, and then you just get fired. Mm-hmm. And this one student, I still remember him, he got fired from his first job. I said that. But I said, he didn't get fired from his first 2 jobs. Because when he gets fired from his first job, he's going to say, this person doesn't know what they lost, and I'm great on this. And he's resigned, and it's not going to change. And he did. And he did. He got fired from his second job. Then he started a company with 2 other guys, and they ran for a year or so, and he couldn't stand working with them because they weren't doing what he wanted, and he quit. And then he came back to graduate school, and actually came back to Clemson in graduate school, and now he'd be the best employee. I would recommend him to anybody in the world. But he needed those two things. It's almost like an entrepreneur. You look at how many entrepreneurs that end up being successful. Most of the successful ones had one crash. They had one, they went broke or whatever, and then they just, took another shot at it and they got it. And sometimes they just need that for people. But not everybody can be built that way. Some people are just working good right from the beginning.
Yeah. I think I got goosebumps because I think you're tapping into something that is near and dear to my heart, right? Well, is something that I'm passionate about right now, and that is that, we have a bit of an epidemic. I think that we've, because of the cocooning effect that has taken place in our world, the fact that we can hide from everybody and that we don't want to have conflict and so you've got some of these awful things happening in the world, and it further entrenches us in there, and we all kind of cling to our little safe places. And what happens there is that we become very parochial. Like you talk about the family, and I think that's critical. I think that instilling the work ethic and accountability, and that, you know, you can make mistakes, and, you know, but you got to own up to them. And that has all, that's been a part of our culture for, you know, a couple hundred years. And in this environment, it's, there's a lot of blame, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing. It's kind of like that kid that you're talking about. I mean, it's a great story. It's a great anecdote because, you know, here's a kid who comes along and it's, you know, it's everybody else's fault. And until he's knocked down a peg, until he has that experience of rejection or making a mistake and realizing that it was on him, you know, that's when you come back. And that goes back to self-esteem. I think collectively we need that. And at the same time in business, we have this world that's all about ROI. It's all about, I'm going to make an investment and I want to return immediately. And so that further puts people in a position where they don't want to stick their neck out. They want to hide. They don't want to take risks. You know, you've already got this culture of, you know, it's not anybody else's fault. If, you know, I've grown up in a world where, you know, maybe I never made a mistake kind of deal. And then you go to this corporation where the corporation says, you know, you better darn well not make a mistake or you're out. And so people feel that. And so we have both sides have to work. I think we've got to get to a place where, like I told my son this, he made a mistake last week, and he was really, really bummed about it. And he was down on himself, and he says, I'm an idiot. And you know, I could have yelled at him, and I said to him, I walked into his room, and I said, listen, it's just an honest mistake. I mean, you know, he forgot to do something. And I said, it's an honest mistake. Now, if it repeats itself, then we got a problem, and that's becoming a habit, and which becomes character, I said. But, you know, I don't want you to feel like you can't make a mistake. And you know, we need to have that. That's a culture, I think, that we need to foster in our business community, especially going back to what you were talking about, and that is everything's changing so fast that there's really no experts anymore. So mistakes have to be made. And so I worry that we have these two colliding cultures. We've got this culture from the business side that's saying, you know, I got to have everything perfect. Don't make a mistake because I'll blame you immediately. And then we've got these kids growing up in a world where, you know, they've never made a mistake, you know, because mommy and daddy have told them that they're wonderful. And so we need, and then, you know, here's the school in the middle kind of going, yeah, I'm not going to redo it. I'm not here to parent you. You know, we've got to teach that ability to take accountability and be okay with it. Do you think I'm off base with that?
No, I think you're right. I think the thing I keep trying to push to the faculty in my department was, you know, listen, you know, we can sit there and try to give them money as everything they want, but if we figure out how to help them tap into the other things that make, you know, a lot of people are uncomfortable and, you know, and as a general rule, it's not all millennials, but a lot of people just have a sense that they have this, you know, they feel like they've already earned all this and they should be able to do whatever they want. And I think those are you know, characteristic, but not an absolute. And I think what we need to do is, how do we set our bar of what we expect out of the students, so they're getting an idea of what the future businesses are going to expect out of them, and we challenge them to be successful. So I think you're right on target. But again, I think it has an awful lot to do with parenting. And I, you know, I look back, the first time I heard of helicopter parents, mm-hmm. And I've had a few run-ins with them as a teacher. You know, and a parent called me and threatened to sue me and all sorts of stuff and wow. About their child. And you know, I'm sitting there going, you know, these are my peers. These are my, in other words, the people that created, the people that helicopter people, those are my peers. It's the baby boomers that have done this. And like we were doing it trying to do better. Now, I sit there and I look at it and I tell a lot of people that have if I was half of what my dad was, I'd have been a really good dad. I had a really great dad. Mm-hmm. And I screwed up. I've done some things. I still remember the one thing I realized that my dad never really talked about his job or his work. And so I made a point to talk about my job and my work. And there were some things that probably weren't as good about doing that. So, you know, I try to do things and be smarter than my dad, and ended up almost every place I did that, I sort of screwed up. Mm-hmm. But no, I think we as the baby boomers need to, you know, sit back and realize that we're the ones that created this problem. Because it's like you said, we try to protect our kids and we try to make sure that they have everything. And then I think the other thing, maybe it's all a perfect storm, because I think the other side is technology. Mm-hmm. I think one of the worst things that's ever happened is a smartphone. Because, you know, I just look at students. It's funny, the building next to where I teach has a lecture hall with about 300 students in it. So when class lets out and they're walking out of the front of the building, you know, go back 10 years and they'd be coming out talking and everything. Now they come out and there's three, four of them across and they're all on their phones. They're not even talking to each other anymore. It's a totally different environment. Yeah. And I think that technology, for everything that good it's brought, I think it's brought a lot of negative things, or the other side that I think goes with that is, I mean, I've had students that have sent me, you know, scathing emails that, you know, and I responded to what the email was, and I said, you know, I will not talk to you again in an email. If you want to talk any further on this, you come and stand in front of me face to face. Because you never would have gotten those words out. You never would have been able to say what you said, and it was rude, it was inappropriate. Right. And I think that's, you know, and that's another thing that goes along with social media. I mean, I think social media is a great thing, but it's also a terrible thing. I mean, it's because people misuse it, and so I think we're sort of dealing with a whole bunch of things that are all happening at one time, and nobody knows how to deal with these things or how to temper it.
Yeah, they don't.
I sit there. I look back and say, well, I would have done stuff different with my child if I'd known today what I know today. Back then, I would have limited things more. I would have limited the exposure. But now, my gosh, they're giving cell phones to 8-year-olds. That's crazy to me.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. I do think, you know, you know, I'm doing a lot of work inside and outside the industry. We do a lot of custom content, and we've got a higher education magazine that we do, and so we've done some work around Gen Z, you know, the next generation. My kids are Gen Z, and you know, I can see, you know, like I can't ever see my kids, you know, sending a scathing email. They're not on the they're not on Twitter. They're not on this stuff. And in fact, they really will not send anything out. Now, at the same time, they're both involved in athletics, and they see some of the stuff, and it's highly discouraged, because, you know, people will see that, and coaches or scouts or whatever, and so they are growing up in an environment where they are seeing all the bad stuff that comes from social media. So my hope is that there's a little bit of a backlash in this next group that realizes that, you know, I don't need to take a selfie or tweet every little aspect of my life. Now they're sitting there watching their devices a lot. So I still think their heads are down. And I worry about their ability to communicate with one another and have real engagement. And I do think that, you know, as tough as the industry has been over the course of the last 10, 15 years, you know, there's a dynamic component to the industry because, you know, of all these changes, but also because of what print offers. I still think it does offer a little bit of that ownership, and the tactile feel, the haptic nature of it is a big deal. And you know, I see, like you were saying, you know, newspapers are dead, and it is interesting. I think that you're right, and I think we typically will say, oh, it's the way that we get news has changed. And that's true, But there's also another piece to it, and that is, what is news? And so what is content, what is news, differs for each of us. I don't think things are content until we deem them, the reader, the person digesting it, says it's content. And because there's just so much stuff out in the world, there's more than ever. I mean, each day there's more than there was in the history of the world. But what's news to me might be, hey, I'm a Clemson alumni and I want to know. And so guess what? I'm probably going to want to see that in print. I want to spend some time with it, you know. And I think if you recall a couple of years ago when I spoke at down in Florida for that conference that you were involved in, you know, I pulled out my phone and I said, how many emails can I delete in 10 seconds? And it was like 18 emails in the blink of an eye. That stuff's here and gone, and print still has that. You know, so print has a role in this reboot, this re-education that I'm hoping. Like, you and I think, totally agree that we're in this day and age where, yeah, I mean, there's blame, they're head down. You know, they feel like they can just take liberties and say things like that. I think there's some manners I'm hoping that will come back. I think that you go through this and you learn and you realize, wait a minute, you know, our country was built on hard work. Our industry is about solid connection. I'm hopeful that there's some backlash. Yes, there's been some of this other stuff going on, but I think print or the industry plays a role in that. Do you?
Yeah, I agree. I think so. I think that, you know, I think when people are just sitting there saying, you know, I was talking to one salesperson the other day, and they're talking about, you know, how focused they are on digital, and like they don't want to get a white paper. I'm like, well, some people do, and a white paper has more details than an infograph. And I think when you need it, if it's the right thing, it's what you want. So, yeah, I think, you know, we're still trying to force something in print that doesn't belong there anymore and it's better served someplace else. But that's what a good printer does in today's world. A printer does more than just put ink or toner on paper. A printer satisfies the needs of the customer. Right. And if the customer needs a printed mail piece and then they need a web page and then they need someplace where somebody's going to buy something online, then the printer helps support all of those things. And I think that's, again, where are we going to be? I think the one thing that's a guarantee is we're going to be more integrated than ever 5 years down the road, and 5 years past that we'll be more integrated again, and we're going to keep integrating everything. But I don't think you're going to see print go away. I really don't. I think that there's too many things that print does better than anything else. I mean, you can't wrap M&M's with your cell phone. You know, you can't get M&M's out of the cell phone. You need a package. But it's not just packages. It's signs. It's banners. It's posters. It's all sorts of things that are just tools. And if people recognize that they're satisfying customers' needs, they're going to be fine.
Right.
But if they're thinking that they're just delivering ink or toner on paper, they're going to be out of business.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. Well, let me ask you this, and then I'll let you go on this rainy Memorial Day. So tell me, so what you're doing now? You and I talked about it, but let the listeners know kind of what you're going to go off and do now, and then I want to ask you kind of your advice for the industry.
Okay. Well, I had a really good career, 40 years teaching, and I've got a pension. And I always tell people that I think God gave me the right talents to be a good teacher and to satisfy it. So my second career, and I'm starting, and been working on a master's degree in theology. So my second career is I'm going into ministry. I'm going to become an ordained deacon in the Catholic Church. Ordination, if everything works out right, will be in February of next year. And I think it's... I have a prison ministry that I think will expand, and then just sort of working with a lot of other elements inside the church. People think I'm crazy when I say this, but I know a lot about mailing. And one of my first goals is to make a pitch to the bishop to go around the state and teach all of the churches how to use intelligent mail barcode for small business and save money for their church.
That's awesome.
And well, I figure that God's smart enough to, you know, use the things that he's given me in the last 40 years in the next 10 or 15 years that he allows me to do this. So, you know, I think it's, and in a way it's payback, but it's also, I also tell people that, you know, getting old, and if I'm going to fight for something, I want to fight for something that I really, really believe in. And I really believe in Christianity. I really believe in the message of Jesus Christ. And that is where I'm putting emphasis for the rest of my life.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate it. I was thrilled to hear that when you told me that a couple weeks back. And you know, I do. I think it's cool. And I believe that, you know, there's something there in terms of, you know, our industry is, you know, regardless of where you stand on religion and spirituality, I think that our industry has a level of spirituality to it. I mean, it does. It's all about connecting, and you know, when you're putting ink on paper, there's definitely a more intimate engagement, and so I think it follows. So that's really cool, and I'm really excited for you. I think that's great. So all right, so if as you move on, and I just can't wish you more. I just wish you so much luck in that. But if you could tell this industry, a printer, anybody, a new person in the industry, as we move forward, what would be your advice?
My advice is they need to support education better. They need to go in and help yes, I'm talking about graphic communications programs specifically for mine, but it's not just that. It's anywhere. They need to become an active part in the local schools, in the local colleges. They need to go in and help give the kids purposes, whether it's part-time jobs in the summer, internships, just support. But I think it's huge when somebody from the industry comes in and explains what they do, shows people what they do, gets kids interested in it, and shows them the exciting part of the field. The other thing that everybody needs to help people start to understand is when they graduate and they get out, it's called work. It's a job. And they're not going to like every part of the job, but they have to recognize that the world works right because everybody's doing their job. And I think that we think the schools can do it all by themselves, but they can't. They need the people to come in and be supportive and be active and find a way to get involved. And not just it's not just the owner of the company saying, "Oh, I'll write a check, I'll help." It's, you know, people going in and volunteering and helping, bringing it in, having tours. I keep telling the post office, I was just at the National Postal Forum, you need to make it more regular that kids and people can go in and see that mail is absolutely alive. I mean, USPS they'll process 500 million pieces of mail, over 500 million pieces of mail today. And they'll do that every day this week. And to sit there and say mail's, you know, gone, it's not. And it's still very, very, very relevant in our lives. And I think that people need to see it. And then also, if you see the other amazing fact about the mail is they're going to deliver mail to 180 million different addresses. Well, not today because it's Memorial Day, but any regular day of the week, right, they deliver to over 180 million individual addresses. And that's mind-boggling when you think of the logistics of doing that every single day, day after day after day after day. And so, but they need to, people need to understand what they're doing. And I think the same thing with printers is when people understand what printers can do, or marketing people, or whatever we're talking about, and we tend to just think everybody else is going to take care of it. I also think if you go in and you do some of that, then you give more motivation for the students to learn too. So I just think the industry, there are some great companies and great people, and you've kind of spoken at Clemson, and there are a lot of people. Sometimes you just have to wait, you have to ask them. But what I'm saying is don't wait to be asked, go volunteer. And even if the first time you try to volunteer, you know, don't, if they don't warm up to you, then volunteer again or try somebody else. I mean, sometimes it's just finding the right teacher and the right person, but they need your help in a big way.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great. And I think it's a learning mindset that can be injected into any industry or any business. And so it's not just about engaging and cultivating them, but, new generations of workers, but it's also permeates through your organization as, hey, we're going to reach out, we're going to be involved, because there's a learning that takes place there. So I do think I think the great companies are going to do that. So Listen, I can't thank you enough. I know, you know, and to do this on Memorial Day is really cool. And I just wish you all the best. I hope that you and I are going to stay in touch, and you know, we'll grab a cup of coffee at some point and figure out the world's troubles. But you know, I just thanks for all you've done over the course of 40 years. Thanks for including me in Clemson. I've always enjoyed those presentations, and I really appreciate you doing this.
I appreciate it. I point everybody to your magazines, and I think you're doing an awesome job of helping to educate the industry too. So I appreciate all that as well.
All right, I appreciate it, Doctor, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks enough. I appreciate the time.
All right, John. Take care.
Bye bye.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. John Leiniger from Clemson University. I think that you would agree his insight into both the generations coming forward, the current state of our industry and our economy, the technology in our industry and its future. He's got a really unique perspective. It's been his life's work. He is... been devoted to it. And I just can't thank him enough for taking the time to share some of his insight. I am particularly taken with his idea around teaching by doing. And that strikes me because I believe we're all craving experiences. I believe that we have to force ourselves to get our hands dirty. We have to force ourselves to look people in the eyes and have more conversations. And I understand that we're living in this world where we have the tools to keep us hidden, and that there are many reasons in this world that we want to stay hidden. But that's not where the progress is. You know, progress lies in our ability to take some risks and step out. I think the world is rigged in a world that you have to embrace, or in a way that you have to embrace risk. So I think that Dr. Leiniger believes the same thing, and I just am really, really thrilled to have had him on the program. A reminder that this podcast, Brushstrokes, was brought to you by Convertible Solutions. My friends over there can be found at www.convertiblesolutions.com. Just remember that for 10 years, Convertible Solutions has been creating innovative pre-converted solutions for the digital print industry, allowing you to produce short-run and/or variable data jobs in only the quantity needed and deliver finished converted pieces with no outsourcing required. So again, visit them at convertiblesolutions.com. In the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this Brushstrokes podcast, and I look forward to our next one where we have a real exciting guest. So until then, remember, be the buffalo.